Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Scarlett Leadership Institute monthly Lunch and Leadership conference call. If you would like a copy of today's slides, we will have them posted on the homepage of the website, and you can download those. And if you'd like to share the playback, the webcast will be available on the homepage of the website tomorrow. So if you have some of your colleagues that were unable to participate today, you can share that information with them. So without further ado, I will turn it over to Joe Scarlett.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our monthly Lunch and Learn conference call. A little bit of a commercial to start with. Our Emerging Leaders program starts November 7th. That's 8 days over 8 months, 1 day a month. It's all about leadership education for emerging leaders, typically those who are moving into big responsibility for the first time. And it's really a great class. It's very much like our signature class, but geared down to a little bit different level. Second, I want to let you know that our next conference call with Susan Williams on storytelling for business, which is a very important topic when it comes to communication of business, will be November 16th. So mark that in your calendar, and it's already on the homepage so you can sign up. And our topic today is a wonderful topic, and I'm going to tell you all about a book written by our speaker at the end of today's session. But right now, I want to turn it over to Mary Fink. Mary?
Thank you, Joe. We are so excited to have Margaret Morford with us today. She is the CEO of the HR Edge and works as a consultant with lots of companies, some here, some all over the country, just back from Europe, so I guess international now. And we are talking today about politics in the workplace, and Margaret's going to talk with us about 10 political rules that need to not be broken. Politics doesn't necessarily have to be a dirty word, although today, this month, it probably is for a lot of us.
Well, we're going to do workplace politics, which is much different than what's going on in the country.
Exactly. Margaret has written a book. Joe will talk about that a little at the end. And the other thing I want to share with you is that we've had a lot of interest in this topic, and we are going to be offering a full-day class on office politics, politics in the workplace, in the near future. We are finalizing the date right now, but within the next few days, that information will be on our website. So, Margaret.
Yes.
Tell me something. What do you mean by politics? What I mean, we all have our own thoughts about that. When you say politics to me, I think, ugh. Even in the workplace, I think, ugh. You know, it usually has a negative connotation, but your whole idea is that it doesn't have to be.
It doesn't. And when I talk about politics, I'm really talking about positive politics. So often when people refer to politics, they're talking about people using other people, people stepping on other people. That's not one. It's a very it's bad humanity, but it's a very poor long-range strategy for moving your career forward. Politics for me is the difference between being right and being effective. Politics is sort of the no man's land between that. And so often I will ask a group this question, how many of you have been right and you've made people mad? And everybody always laughs, but if you make people mad, it doesn't matter that you're right. You need to be effective, and effective is the only thing that matters in the work world. How effective are you?
Right. So I guess the reason I should concern myself with knowing about that is that I want to be as effective as possible.
Well, it's about getting your agenda accomplished, so it's about moving your career forward, moving your organization forward, but also gathering allies. So it's a way to move your career forward, focused on not only being truthful, because politics isn't about lying. It is about how you choose to tell a story, how you choose to handle another individual, and understanding the one thing people seem to miss that we talk a lot about in workplace politics are all the unspoken undercurrents that are going on that you really need to understand.
Can you say a little bit more about that in terms of how can I even know about it, first of all, and secondly, how can I counter it, I guess?
Well, politics are there. Occasionally I'll have people that say, oh, I don't play politics. And the thought that goes through my head is, then I hope you like the job you have because you're not going to move forward. It's there. Anytime you get two people together in the workplace, you have competing agendas. It's about resources, how things get accomplished, and so you need to read that really well. You don't read it at someone else's expense, but you do need to understand it. And I got interested in this because I watched more people wreck or stagnate their career because they didn't understand all the unspoken messages and the political tendrils to a situation. Or even if they recognized there were some politics going on, they didn't handle them very well, and it caused all kinds of problems in their own career and for them within their own organization.
So that's how you came to study politics, and then I'm guessing that with your knowledge of HR, because that's the area that you work in, you were able to try to put that information to use in helping people get past that.
Well, politics is certainly about people, and that's where I've concentrated. People, making people better, building great managers, creating leaders. And as I was doing all of that, occasionally I'd watch somebody do something in a meeting and I'd go, oh, I wouldn't have done that. And it had nothing to do with what they said. In a lot of cases, it was how they said it, how they managed a situation. And I came to realize that most people lose their jobs, particularly as they get to middle-level management. They lose their jobs because of politics. They make a mistake, and the mistake is the reason that they're told they're being let go. But the reality is it's usually one of three political things that have happened to them. Either their organization has changed direction and they haven't figured it out, so they're out of step with their organization, which will always cause you issues. They've run afoul of somebody who's powerful in the organization and they don't realize it, or they keep standing on the side of right to their detriment over and over and over again. Or they haven't built a wide enough network to support them when they make a mistake, because people make mistakes all the time, and I think that's the last rule we're going to talk about today.
I've got a high-level story to share with you that goes back 35 years, but when I was with Tractor Supply Company, about a year and a half after I joined the company, the president got fired because he wasn't doing what he should be doing, and another fellow came in, and I was one of a half a dozen vice presidents, and we were all sort of friends with the fellow who got fired. But I realized that, you know, the future is in helping the new fella, which I did, and my peers were resentful of the new fella and steered clear of him. When I worked with him and supported him and helped him, he understood business pretty well, and I was sort of an immature, but I was a retailer. So he was sort of helping me, and I was helping him learn about retailing at the same time. And 3 months later, he made me the number two person in the company because I supported and helped him, and my peers rejected him and tried to stay away from him.
And that's always a mistake and a really common mistake. I can't tell you how many times I've said to people when they said, our CEO has changed or my boss has changed, and I said, then you need to realize that the whole deck's been reshuffled, and you've got to reshuffle your priorities and where you are, because if you don't, again, it's one of the reasons that people get out of step and they stagnate their careers.
And doesn't some of that have to do with when that new person comes on board, stepping back and just listening and watching for a bit? It's not business as usual. It's not I can do things the way I've always done them because they worked with the one that was here before.
Well, people, and I use the analogy of a deck of cards because I think it's easy for people to understand. You know, professional poker players don't get any better cards than anybody else. They've learned how to play them better. And so when you have that kind of change, you need to understand you've just been dealt a whole new hand, and now you got to figure out how to play it differently.
Exactly. Exactly. So I know in your book there are 40-some-odd rules that you talk about, and we'd be here all afternoon, so we've chosen 10. And I'd like to get started with those if we can.
Okay.
The first one is say yes if at all possible. Can't that get me in trouble?
Well, again, I want to emphasize you're going to stay true to yourself, to what you think is the right thing to do for your organization in a particular situation, but there are ways to deliver that information. As you move up in an organization, you're paid for your expertise, and so notice how often you say no. And So we get in the mode of saying no, particularly if you've got any kind of experience at all. If you've got several years of experience and somebody rolls out a new idea, you can normally see the train wreck coming about two sentences in. But here's what happens with that. So you start saying no. The person shuts down. Maybe this was a terrible idea, but their next idea may be the killer one. The chances I'll hear that again if I've closed that door time and time and time again. And it is also about your personal reputation. So oftentimes I'll teach people in a session how to say no or at least surface the issue without being the no person. For instance, Mary, if you roll into my office, you've got this great idea, you're so excited about it, you start telling me about your idea, and two sentences in, I can see what's wrong with it. If you're smart, you sit silently, you let them get all the way through their idea, and then I say this. You know, Mary, we could do that. If we did that, what would you do about, and fill in the blank with your biggest objection to their idea. Now, here's the most powerful political tool I'm going to give you. Shut up. The strategic shut up at the right moment, and we don't do it because we're taught when we ask an awkward question to keep talking. It is awkward because it's a terrible idea, and I just need to sit tight and wait to see what you're going to say. One of two things are going to happen. Either you're going to overcome my greatest objection, which means your thinking's getting better, or here's what's likely to happen. You have no idea. So I end the conversation by saying, Mary, then think about that, and when you've worked that issue out, come on back and let's talk about your idea further. I've not said no. I actually look like I might do it. But you walk away, and the person who winds up killing their idea is you, not me.
Right.
But you walk away thinking she's open to new ideas, she's open to new thinking, she'll hear me out, and that's a great reputation to have.
Absolutely. So it's not really that I'm always saying yes. It's that I'm not immediately saying no.
Correct.
Sometimes I'm going to think about it a little longer. Sometimes I'm going to give you an opportunity to come to your own conclusion about it, but I'm going to remain open.
Well, and what's important there, so often managers will say, well, let me think about that, or I don't know, I can remember hearing somebody's six-year-old child when their parents said, we'll see about that. One of them turned to the other one and said, that means no.
Exactly.
You need to put the burden back on the other person. Otherwise, they just keep waiting for you to come back and discuss their idea. In the example I gave you, it's a terrible idea. It really doesn't need to come to the forefront. But then you get to make the decision. I don't make it for you.
Exactly. Great. Number two, monitor your natural body language to overcome it. I love this one.
I see this a lot. I was talking to somebody just recently, and we had been in a big meeting. And I said, you realize that your CEO knows that you don't like that idea. I didn't say that. I said, you didn't say that, but I watched your body language, as did everybody else, and you could tell that you didn't like the idea, and your CEO knows you didn't like the idea. So often I tell people, I go, you really need to watch, one, how open are you? We have a tendency to just cross our arms, sometimes just for comfort, but it closes your body up, and someone else is reading stuff you don't expect them to read. So you really need to monitor sitting in meetings. I always make sure that I open my body up and that I settle back. I don't cross my arms on the table because people will read it a different way. The other thing I particularly caution people to watch is a smirk to their tone when they've been right. I said, you've been right. Everybody knows you've been right. You don't need to drive it home. And particularly, I call it the very slight smile when the thing you've warned about comes to pass. Nobody likes somebody that's a know-it-all.
I told you so.
Yeah, once there's been an issue and there's a problem, you need to be in there pitching to help work it out. It doesn't matter that you figured out it was going to happen before that. And a caution to managers, your people, the people that report to you, are always watching you. In a particular session, I've asked this question a couple of times when I had the manager sitting right there, and I said, how do you know when they're angry? And I was sitting in one particular session, and somebody piped up and said, oh, you get the look. Mm-hmm. And everybody in the session's nodding their heads, and the manager goes, "What look?" And someone had to actually describe it to him. Another CEO I know, I've worked with some of his direct reports, and I said, "You need to watch for the glasses thing." And they go, "What do you mean the glasses thing?" I said, "He wears readers." And I said, "When he pulls his glasses off and he sets them down, if you hear a click, he's not happy. I'm not talking about just taking them off and setting them down. He is not happy." There was another CEO that I studied on, and we were doing strategic planning, and someone said something, and I watched his shoulders go up. And I said, "Let's take a break." And I pulled him aside and said, "I know this last question was awkward for you." And he was angry. So you need to watch, particularly as managers, be very careful you don't have a body language tell that makes people edit themselves or make them much more aware of your emotions than you think they should be. And it's almost automatic.
Is there a way to know that without someone has to tell you that? And maybe I just become more aware of what I'm doing, or do you sit in a meeting and constantly tell yourself, "Don't do this, don't do this, don't do this," or, I mean, how do I get better?
I think you have to be aware, and sometimes we are not always self-aware. That may not be put together very thoughtfully, but you get what I mean. Go to people that know you well and that you trust. My suggestion, since this is politics, is that you go to people that know you outside of work and ask them this question: how do you know when I'm angry or upset? And ask them to give you the cue and then begin to watch for the cue.
It was one lady who I worked with a tractor supply company whom I got to know very well in the early years, and we developed a good rapport. And from time to time, when I would say something in front of a group that didn't come across right or wasn't well said or something like that or misinterpreted, she on a number of occasions walked into my office, closed the door, and said, "Hey, Joe, sit down." And she'd say, "Do you realize what you just said and how it was received?" And she was dead on target, and it gave me an opportunity to quickly go back and try to correct what I had done incorrectly. So wherever you can develop a confidant at work, somebody who you respect and is not threatened by you, that you get them to talk to you. I didn't even encourage this. She just took the initiative to do it herself, and then I thanked her for it, and she continued to do it.
There's a CEO I know, and he has an administrative assistant that everybody talks to. So he said, "I've been on the job about a month, and I figured it out. Studied how she liked her coffee, called her, and her name was Valerie. Called Valerie in. I had fixed her cup of coffee. I set it on the desk between us and said, 'Okay, queen of the underground, tell me what everybody's talking about.'" And he said, "I don't need to know who's saying what, but I'd just like to know what's going on, what so we can answer
what I need to know."
And she was great, and occasionally she'd roll into his office and say, "You need to fix my coffee again." And they would sit down and talk about what was going on.
That's great.
But when you're in a leadership role, sometimes you can sort of feel when things are not going well. And a number of times I saw that happening, and I adopted a new title for myself. I'd walk up to a group of people, and I'd ask them what's going on. They wouldn't tell me, and then I'd say, "Listen, for today my title is the Vice President of Rumor Control." And all of a sudden people would start talking. I said, "What's the?" And they tell you. And sometimes they were just misinformed, or sometimes we had screwed up as a company. But getting those kinds of things on the table allows you to fix whatever's wrong.
Really helpful. And I think one more comment I'd like to make is that maybe I'm not so self-aware, but if I can become aware of the signals people are giving me back. Because you know when you've upset people, if you're tuned in, and this goes back to our last call with emotional intelligence, if I'm paying attention to other people, they will give me signals.
Sure. If you just look at people. If they usually smile and all of a sudden they're not, you know something's up.
I agree. Exactly. Okay. Always confront in private.
If you want to make an enemy for life, challenge somebody in a meeting about what they believe with 8 or 10 other people looking on. One, they will be angry at you, and you can rip a relationship doing that. The other thing is that it's not very practical, because all you really do when there are 8 other people watching is you drive them to dig in harder on their viewpoint, when what you really want them to do is change their viewpoint. So if you say something in a meeting that I disagree with, if I can sit through the meeting and let it go, I go by your office shortly after the meeting and say, Mary, you said something in the meeting that I've got a problem with, and I wanted to come discuss it with you one-on-one. You're going to have a much better discussion. You don't have eight other people watching you challenge them in public. And you're going to make a friend for life because they'll appreciate the fact that you didn't embarrass them in front of eight other people when you thought there was something wrong with what they said. If I'm sitting in a meeting and what you say I think is going to get the meeting so off track, I need to intervene at that point. You should intervene in such a way that you give the person a chance to save face and step back, change what they believe without it appearing like they made
shifted.
A reverse.
Well, excuse me, but that's a big topic, and it's going to require a lot of time to discuss, and I think we need to table that for now and handle it at the next meeting. Then
yes.
You can go and talk. Everybody's fine with that.
That's one tool. The other one, when you get this has to be done right here, and we need to get the meeting moving in a different direction, is that I'll say to someone, you know, Mary, when you made that decision, I think there's a piece of information no one shared with you that would change where you come out on that. And then I trot out the most persuasive reason I have that she would change her mind, and then I sit quiet and give her a chance to say, well, given that, and what I've just done is signal to her there's something wrong here, and two, say, of course you made that decision because no one shared yet.
Right.
That would make you come out differently, and you give them a graceful way to change their position right there.
Excellent. Okay, number four, say as little as possible on any subject. And that's kind of counter to what some people believe. And we have some big talkers.
Well, everybody tends to think about discourse in the workplace as I need to respond, particularly when you're sitting in a group. What I found by sitting back is 75% of the time the group is going to go the direction I would want it to go in, and I don't need to weigh in.
Right.
You've all experienced those people that comment on everything. So what happens over time is their comments cease to mean much. I want you to think about your words in the workplace as a savings account. You need to decide what are the one or two or three things I have to get accomplished, and you put everything you have behind that, and then you sit silent on the other things, and don't waste your words. Let someone else champion those. What happens, and when I talk about power signals in the book, this is one of the power signals. I always say watch for those people that say very little, but when they open their mouths, because people are not used to hearing from them, everybody stops because they want to hear what they've got to say. So it is a way to give your words great weight because people don't hear them all the time. Otherwise, you become, if you've seen the Peanuts cartoon with Charlie Brown and his teacher, blah, 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 and you never want anybody
right.
to hear that when you start to speak.
Exactly.
As a senior executive, what I often saw happen is people would come to you with an idea and they would just inundate you with information. When you're dealing with senior people, if you want to get ahead, give them a short picture, give them a big picture, but a very short one, and people can digest it. And if the senior executive wants to hear more, they'll ask for more. But when you inundate them with too much information, the next time they see you coming, they're going to try and duck into a different office before you can get to them, before they get to you.
Yeah, I always say never mistake forbearance for interest.
I like that. Okay. Watch checking electronic communication in meetings or in-house sponsored seminars, and we struggle with that every day.
Well, I understand the need for it. We live in a world where you got to be in touch, but nobody thinks about, and just because you can do it and you're good at watching what's going on in the meeting and concentrating on what's going on and answering your email, there are a bunch of unspoken messages that get attached to that. Think about this. When a meeting is called, whoever's leading the meeting has enough power to bring whoever this group is together. Or for me, as a consultant, when I'm in to teach a session for somebody and there's somebody in the back of the room constantly on their electronic device, someone has paid a lot of money, and it's not just for me, but it's for all the people to sit in that room. And so the unspoken messages, think about them. There are about three of them. The first one is this person, I'm certainly not powerful as I come in from the outside, but I've clearly got some kind of power sponsor who's spending that money, and they're watching what's going on in the room. So when you do that, one of the unspoken messages is this isn't important. And that is not something you want to communicate to somebody who's powerful in an organization or as a powerful sponsor. The other one is it has an arrogance feel to it. What I have to do is more important than what's going on here. Or I guess the best, worst unspoken message they could get from that is that you're boring. And that is not something you want to attach to someone who's powerful or has a sponsor. So while you can do it, I don't think you should. And one of the just small things about meetings like that is somehow people believe as they get to watch when you've got a meeting at a long conference table, it always fills up from the back forward because somehow people believe that halfway down the conference table they've become invisible and nobody's watching their behavior. Or sitting in a seminar or session that's being sponsored by your organization, the person that's leading the session has a field of vision that's about 2.5 feet taller than anybody in the room. They can see everything. In the front of the room, you can't see what the back of the room's doing, vice versa, but the person leading the message sees everything. And the one I particularly find interesting are the people who have put their phone in their lap, and the whole time you've got a seminar going, they either look like they're praying, which I hope they're not praying the seminar is going to be over soon, or you know they're checking electronic communication. Now, if you have to do it, if you have to do it, I've got two suggestions. First of all, go see who's ever leading the meeting and tell them, I'm on call. I've run into this quite a bit with people that are in IT. We've got a system thing going on. And don't forget to say, this is really important to me, but I have to monitor this and I may have to slip out, but I will slip out so I don't disturb the seminar. It's always a good thing to do with whomever is in charge of that. The second thing is if you're going to have to do that, sit in the very back of the room and try to sit back further than anybody else so everybody isn't watching that behavior go on the whole time it's going on. It's a small thing, but there's a lot of unspoken messages attached to that.
There really is. So how have you seen people handle it on the front end who didn't want to have to deal with it in the middle of the meeting? What are some things that you've seen people do to let people know this is not appropriate, this is not going to be tolerated? Or, I mean, I've had some CEOs who said, I have a basket at the door and you drop your phone in when you come in. You don't even bring it in the room with you.
I think it's a balance. And all of this is balance with a lot of explanation. I actually work with a senior management group, and if your phone goes off during the meeting, you owe everybody in the meeting $10. I've watched an executive have to hand out $100 to everybody in the room. That's a bad thing. You need to monitor your own behavior, whether the person leading the meeting requires that or not. You need to require it of yourself because you need to understand the messages you send about yourself when you don't monitor yourself. And this is particularly a good hint for people that are the millennial generation. They're very connected. That's the way they're used to communicating, and it's very helpful if you're the millennial that never checks their stuff because it says, this person is really interested in what I have to say. Nobody gets a look inside your head to see if you're interested, but you want them to believe you're interested whether you are or not.
If you're on your electronic device, you are showing a lack of respect for whoever's doing the speaking, and you want to, if you want to earn respect, you've got to show respect.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely. Deliver bad news face-to-face.
Well, along with electronic communication, it's really become the mode of communication in business. But it is communication. It is not conversation. And so often people think of it as the same thing, and it's not. And because people tend to opt for electronics, you want to be somebody different. If you have bad news for somebody, oh, we all would like to deliver that electronically, so we're not there for it. So I'm going to encourage you to be somebody different, and when it's bad news, I have to go see this person face-to-face. Now, you can be brave, but I want you to be smart when you're brave. So if I have bad news for you, Mary, when I come to see you, I preface it by telling you, I take 60 seconds on the front end by telling you bad news is coming. Because oftentimes when you surprise people, when you just lay it out there, they're not prepared for it. They're more likely to just explode because they say the first thing that's going through their head, which isn't productive
right.
for any kind of discussion at all. So as I sit down to talk with you, I'll have this brief conversation. Mary, what I'm about to tell you, you're not going to like, but I respect you way too much not to come tell you face to face. It also appeals to the thing we have inside us as a human being, which is to be fair. To be fair. So people will accord you the same amount of respect you accord them. And so often, no matter how bad the news is, the lead off from the other person is, you're right, I don't like that, but I do respect the fact that you would come tell me face to face. Then you've ratcheted down all the tempers. You're going to have a much more productive discussion, which is really what you want out of this. And you have said in an unspoken way, I respect you. And people can deal with anybody that they know respects them. Now, for the people, every once in a while, it's not possible because of geographic limitations, or if you're working globally, it's impossible to do it face-to-face. Then call them on the phone. Because they can hear your voice, they can understand how emotionally involved you are, that you have great empathy for what's about to come from here. They can't get that from an electronic message. And just an extra little tip, call them, particularly if you're dealing, say, in Asia or in Europe, call them at the point at which their day begins and make this point. When you call them to start with, they're going to be stunned. When they answer the phone, they go, oh my gosh, it must be midnight where you are. It is midnight. But what I have to tell you, you're not going to like, and I wanted to get you when you're fresh at the beginning of your day so you could deal with that. That is a concern for them and not a concern for you. And it's very hard for that conversation to go awry after that because they understand you've done everything you can to make this as easy as possible. And it's just a matter of respect, and you're going to trade on. People will give you the same amount of respect you give them.
These are some wonderful tools, and I suspect that the first time I use them is going to be awkward, but it's like everything else. If we decide this is how we're going to do it, and we're going to practice even, perhaps, or get used to those words coming out of our mouth, it will be so much easier down the road, and as you said, with such a better outcome.
Well, if you have a couple of really good two or three sentence start off,
right.
then even if you don't handle the bad news as well as you wish you had, people are going to forgive you a lot
right.
because they understand it comes from concern for them and how it affects them. It's sort of like some stranger can tell you something and it'll make you really angry, but somebody you know cares about you and is concerned and this is about your own well-being, you'll listen to all kinds of things from them that you wouldn't hear from a stranger.
Exactly.
And this opens that relationship.
Exactly. Thank you. Number seven, never speak negatively about your boss. Is that a challenge?
Yes, yes. Are there some bad bosses out there? Oh, my gosh, yes. And I always believed I could work for anybody until I ran into a boss whom I affectionately refer to as the spawn of Satan. But here's the good news about bad bosses. Everybody knows who they are. And so if everyone knows that you work for somebody who's abusive, who's narcissistic, whatever flavor that bad boss comes in, if you resist the temptation to not talk about your boss, you send all these great unspoken messages back into the organization about you. The message that I'm loyal. No matter how bad this person is, I'm a loyal employee. You also send the message that you can work with anybody, which is a great reputation for anyone to have. And people always personalize situations as they look at them. So the person who's watching you not talk about a boss everyone knows is terrible says, well, if this person won't speak badly about that individual, I can depend upon them not to speak badly about me. That's always a good reputation. You also send the message, I can handle even the most extreme pressure. And you also develop the reputation for being a consummate diplomat. All of those are all great things, and you do all that simply by resisting the temptation to say something everybody already knows is true.
There's no upside to saying anything bad about anybody. And when I think about interviewing people, you're interviewing somebody for a job. If they start talking badly about their previous boss, I immediately think, well, what are they going to say about me if I hire them? So they sort of take themselves out of the mix just by saying bad things about the previous boss.
Exactly. I had one of my bosses say, I hired you, and it was very early on in my career. I was eager, and I was a hard worker, but I didn't have many credentials beyond that. And he told me when I got to know him really well, he says, I just want you to know the only reason I hired you was because I knew who you were currently working for, and they were terrible, and I never could get you to say anything terrible about them. And I just decided I'd like to have somebody working for me like that.
Wow.
Now, Mary, if I can just add one other thing, I do like to offer balance and practical suggestions. Don't speak well of your boss either. Everybody knows they're a monster. Don't make it up. You need to be true to yourself, and what you're really doing is being silent, because you also don't want people to think you're clueless, because everyone knows this person is tough to work for.
Or have some reason not to tell the
truth. Yes, exactly.
Right. Excellent. Thank you. Number 8, understand your boss's personal value system.
So often when I teach politics, I get lots and lots and lots of questions about managing up. And when you're managing up with your boss or somebody a level above you or several levels above you, there is sort of an extra layer of politics that you encounter. And this is probably one of the best suggestions I could make. And Joe, something you said earlier, this falls in really nicely with that. You need to understand what your boss's personal value system is. And don't ask them, because, again, it may be like the body language thing. Most of them aren't even aware that they have a personal value system. Get very focused on what is it they talk about, what is it they hone in on, what is important to them. And then when I get ready to present any kind of project at all, I look at the one I want, the one that I think is the direction we should go in, and I present it in terms of their value system.
Through their lens.
Yes. For instance, I had one CEO, he focused on employee morale, because he was always asking me questions like, what are they saying out in the offices, or what was the reaction from the employees when we rolled that out? How was morale? So once I got several questions like this, the thing he's focused on is he wants people to be happy they're working here. So when I would present him with options, I would show him all the options, and I would go, this is the one that works for the most number of people. That's the one he always went for because it appeals to his personal value system. Now, I've been fortunate to work for a lot of different CEOs who have a lot of different styles. I had one particular CEO who was probably one of the most driven individuals I've ever worked for. It was always bottom line, bottom line, bottom line. I learned to present things to him in about 60 seconds because that was his tolerance to discuss an issue. And what was the biggest clue for me was I was traveling with him, and we're sitting in an airport waiting for our plane, and he's listening to his voicemail, and I watched him delete a voicemail from the senior VP of sales. And he goes, too long, and he just deletes it. And I was so stunned. I said, but what if it's important? He goes, then he'll call back. And he'll be much more circumspect and clipped about what he wants. So after that, for him, he would always ask, bottom line, what's the bottom line? And so when I would present him with options, I'd go, here are all the things we looked at. This is the one that gives us the most for the dollars we spend. He'd go for it every single time. So understand your bosses and anybody that's important to you above the food chain, what's their value system, but don't ask them, study on them, because most of the time I suspect neither one of my CEOs would have been aware that's what their value system is and that's what they focused on.
So many of these you've talked about, I need to watch, I need to listen, I need to observe. Are any of these the kind of thing that I might talk about with a colleague? Or is that sort of not the thing?
I think you need to do your own study, particularly with colleagues, because you one, you don't want to make your colleagues uncomfortable that you're studying them at a level they're not even aware of.
Well, and I really meant a colleague about someone else, like about the boss's values or whatever.
I think what happens there is, one, they may not understand what you're asking them. And I think you tend to take their opinion over your own observation. You're always better with your own observation.
I'm not necessarily in favor of it. I just wanted you to speak to it because I think I would be coming from a different place from my colleagues, so we're going to see it differently anyway.
Perhaps, and they may be a great source of information for you. I think you've got to choose carefully who you want to bring into that circle and make sure that their view doesn't color your view.
Right. Or counteract it.
Yes.
Or counter it. Okay. Number nine, who is the consigliere in your organization? This is a fun one.
This is from the Godfather movie.
Right.
If you remember, the consigliere, I had to look up the pronunciation of that. That is the advisor to the Godfather. There's only one person more powerful in the mafia family, and that's the Don himself. This is the second most powerful person. I use it with your boss. I also use it with the CEO or the whatever that top-level person is. When your organization is under stress, watch who this individual goes to talk to one-on-one. It's normally one individual, somebody they trust, somebody that they're absolutely confident in their advice. And so you want to know, one, who that is. You want to get to know that person because somebody very powerful in your organization trusts their advice. You want them to know who you are, to respect what you bring to the table, because that's always good for your career, for someone powerful to have positive things to say about you. So figure out who it is and get to know them.
And it's not manipulation.
There's nothing wrong. Let me say this. There is nothing wrong with promoting your own career. You should. If you're smart, you do. There is something wrong with promoting your career at the expense of others or at the expense of your organization. Your organization's needs come first, but there's nothing wrong with blending your needs in with those.
And I wanted to get that out there.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Last one, build a wide network of supporters to prevent piling on.
Well, if you remember in the very beginning, I said one of the biggest mistakes people make in politics is that they don't build a wide enough network. Watch what happens to somebody that's in trouble in an organization. They've made a huge mistake. Everybody knows about it. Or the one that's a little more subtle is watch the VP of sales when the numbers are down. He or she is in a lot of trouble, and that's going to work its way through the system. When someone's in trouble, we occasionally, as human beings, we go back to what they refer to as our primitive brain. So at our very core, we're pack animals. And when we sense that somebody's down, you watch what happens. Everybody talks about every mistake they've ever made, every stupid thing they've ever seen them do. And so this mistake becomes huge and momentous for this particular individual to get through. If you built a wide enough network, you'll hear people say things like, yeah, that was a pretty big mistake Margaret made, but that's not like her. You know, I've never seen Margaret do something like that. We've all made mistakes, and I've seen some people survive some what I would have thought of were career-ending mistakes, but they had such a wide network, they were able to survive that and survive the piling on
right.
That seems to occur around organizations.
I want to go back to a story from my early career prior to Tractor Supply. The company had brought in a new fairly senior executive whom I reported to, and he was really a jerk, and everybody knew it. And then he didn't like me because I was pretty tough with him. I tried to make him accountable. And so he called. I was well-networked in the organization, and he called a recruiting firm and put in a job order to replace me and never talked to me. And I found out about it because he put it out with a friend of mine, so I went into him, and because I was well-networked, I knew what was going on. I walked into him. I said, Alan, do you have a problem with me? And he sort of stuttered, and as soon as I left there, he called and canceled the job order for my replacement.
Wow.
Well, powerful people, not only do you want to have a wide network, but you want to have powerful people in your network. I can remember a lesson I got from an executive that was incredibly valuable. We were meeting in senior management. We were going to talk about making an acquisition, and it was clear that the CEO wanted to make this acquisition, and the other vice presidents were thinking this was not a good idea. So I said to one of my counterparts, I said, we're going to talk about that Wednesday, but it's no problem because I've gotten out and counted the votes, which is always smart, hotly contested issue. You need to figure out where everybody is before the meeting takes place there. Now, so I'm thinking I've been very politically astute until this person says, Margaret, what you don't realize is there are some people sitting in that room that have more votes than others.
Bingo.
And that's, you know, as you get smarter about this, you have to get smarter about the subtleties in this.
I wanted to say something else about it, and that was not only is that important for you to have your own network so that you don't get piled on, but it also says something about the people in your network that about sort of like what we've talked about before, that they would be silent or loyal in that time of trouble as opposed to joining the rest of the group and just jumping in.
Exactly. A network will help you survive, and it will stop the damage that can be done to you during that period.
And strengthen the members.
Yes, absolutely.
Strengthen the members. Well, this has been a great conversation, and I'd like to open it up now to questions. So *7 to ask a question on the phone and online. Enter your question and hit ask. And we are waiting for your questions now.
We
do have a question, a caller that's up on the phone. Go ahead with your question.
Hi. Yes, I was actually just wondering if you found yourself possibly falling into some of these practices that you don't suggest, and you're not leaving your company anytime soon, is this something that you should start practicing immediately, and do you think you can overcome the opinions that people already have of you in your company? Is that a struggle, or what would you suggest?
Yes, absolutely. Most of these things you can fix by just changing your behavior. Now, let me warn you, if you've been doing a particular behavior that I said don't do, stop, and it'll take you probably 8 to 10 months to sort of live that down as a behavior. But if you start doing something different, here's what they start to say about you. You know, she used to do that, but she doesn't do that anymore. And it's a recognition of the change of behavior. Most things, when I teach a course on this, as I go through some of the rules, I'll hear somebody go, and I go, none of these things are fatal. You just have to change them. And here's just, I'll give you a tool. If you've gotten sideways with somebody, if you've had a relationship that's gotten off track, there's nothing wrong with going and sitting down with them and saying to them, I perceive that our relationship is not what it should be, and I want to know what I need to do to restore it, not what do we need to do, what do I need you to do. What do I need to do to restore it? It is one of the most compelling messages anybody can have, anybody can receive, because it says you matter, and I'm going to do all the work.
And I own it, yeah.
Yeah, and I own it, and I'm going to do all the work. And I think that's really important. Now, they'll either tell you what's bothering them or not. Sometimes I'll get people that say, yeah, I don't have a good relationship with them, but when they came to ask me about it, I'm just not going to get into that. Even if they won't tell you, they will respect the fact that you've come to see them, and it will at least help move that relationship forward. Does that help you or answer your question? And Joe, you wanted to add something to that.
I can think of several experiences that I've had where I have realized that I've really done something very, very wrong, and I've gone to those people and apologized and said, gee, I know I screwed up. I know that wasn't the right thing to do, and I apologize for that. And it's amazing how well that sits with people. You go back and do that, all of a sudden, in one case at least, we became best friends. So when you know you've stepped done the wrong thing, apologize for it. You will earn tremendous respect.
And let me just say this. When you make that apology, don't make what I call a politician's apology. I'm sorry, but. Or I'm sorry I'm embarrassed to my family. You know, they're not sorry. they're sorry they embarrassed their family. They're not sorry they did what they did.
They're sorry they got caught.
Yes. So take full responsibility. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done that. And talk about how it affected them. There's a wonderful thing to this person wronged me, and they came back and said, I'm sorry, and they understood how it made me feel.
Absolutely.
And if you're in a leadership role and you screw up, you just say, hey, I screwed up. Everybody respects you for that.
Hugely powerful.
Yes. Yes. But state what you've done very specifically. That's really important. Not just, I'm sorry, but I'm sorry I did this and the reason you shouldn't have done it.
What if I have, okay, what if I'm the boss and I have done some things to my or with my team or around working with my team, and I want to let them know that I'm changing. Do I tell them? Or I guess I could apply even one-on-one. Do I tell people that I'm making a change, or do I wait for them to see the action?
I know you're not going to like this answer, but it depends.
Okay.
It sort of depends on what you've done and what your group is like. You can either start doing the behaviors, which was my recommendation. You can either start doing the behaviors and they'll talk about how you've changed. Or if you really think you're going to make a pretty big right turn and you can stick with it, that's a thing that I'm always concerned about. If you apologize for the behavior, but it's a way, it's sort of a mode of behavior, it's easy to slip back into that. And you'll tell them you've changed and then they go, nope, they haven't changed. So I tend to think I just need to change and then wait for them to watch that take place.
I agree, because I can say I'm going to change and I may have every intention of doing it, but the first mistake I make, everybody goes, we knew this wouldn't last.
Exactly, and you don't want that to happen.
Okay, we have another question online. If the politics between a holding company and a subsidiary are challenged, or between two departments are challenged, for example, how do you affect change at the macro level?
Well, you get to choose your own behavior. So often I have people, they'll go, well, you know, I agree with everything you've said, but not in my organization. So it doesn't really matter what your culture is. It's how you choose to show up. It's the reason that, you know, I'm fortunate enough to be in and out of 10 or 12 businesses a month. I'll find these organizations that have great cultures, and I'll find these pockets of people that hate their job, and usually that has to do with what's going on in the group. I also occasionally go into an organization that has terrible culture, and you'll find these groups of people that love their job, and it has to do with how their manager chooses to come to work. It's your personal choice.
And sometimes groups fall into groupthink.
Yeah.
And group behavior. And if one person chooses to change, then it can have an influence over the whole group, because all of a sudden that's not the preferred behavior, or that's not the prevalent behavior. Something's different here. It feels different. So maybe I should.
Well, and you can work for anybody. You can work. I've seen someone work for one of the worst narcissists I've ever seen. And in talking to them about how they get things done, they go, well, here's what I figured out. As long as it is, this one happened to be a male, as long as it's his idea, we go down the path I think we should go down. Now, I've been smart enough always when I roll out an idea to him that I think is going to become his idea, I always follow it up with email. So there's a trail that says the idea was originally mine. And I think that's smart. You can work for, I talked to somebody who works for one of the worst micromanagers I've ever seen, and I was quizzing them. I said, tell me about your relationship with Joe, and the person said, you mean how do I work for the worst micromanager on the face of this earth? And I laughed and said, I don't think that's what I ask you, but he says, well, he's got to put his mark on any project I do. So he's going to make one change, always, even if it's a perfect project. And I used to bring in these great projects, and he would make one change and make it worse. So now when I prepare a project for him, I leave one thing that I know needs to be changed. It's not real obvious, but he's going to figure it out. He changes it. I'm happy because the project's perfect, and he's happy because he got to touch it. Now, I have to be honest, Mary, I don't know that I could do that.
I know.
But this is someone who said, I want to stay there. This is They've really gone, this is the hand I've been dealt. Now, how do I play it well? And they play their hand well.
Exactly.
And they've done well in their organizations. Even their narcissistic boss will recommend them for promotion.
We have time for one more question. So if you would enter your question online and hit ask or hit *7 and fire away.
Okay. You mentioned that managers run into trouble fighting for what is right. Do we have to put our ethics aside in order to advance? What's the best way to advance while holding on to your beliefs?
No, it is not about not being true to yourself. I always tell people when you're faced with a highly charged political situation, and most people don't have a lot of trouble recognizing those, you need to ask yourself two questions. What is the right outcome for my organization so that you're being true to what does my organization need? And then what's the political outcome I need? And that's normally how do I enhance this relationship with this person I'm dealing with? Or how do I hold it together and get the right result at the same time? Once you get clear on the answers to both of those, the strategy that works between those becomes pretty obvious. But you don't need to abandon the answer to that first question, which is what is the best thing for the organization? You have to stay true to the right thing. If you have to compromise your ethics to get something done, you need to ask yourself whether this is the right place for you, because you must work someplace that's in line with your ethics, but there's a difference between that and being right and making people mad. You can be right without making them mad.
Exactly.
From a leadership perspective, if you know the ethics are right in the parent organization but not in your particular work unit, you need to find some way to discuss that with somebody else in the organization, typically the HR department.
Exactly. Or somebody high up that's got a lot of influence. That's the key. It's not always numbers. It's hitting the right person with enough influence to actually address that issue that you've raised.
Exactly. Margaret, this has been a wonderful conversation, and I really appreciate you being with us and look forward to having you with us for future conversations about other topics. But Joe, do you want to?
I want to wrap it up with a few things. First of all, Margaret, it's great to have you here, I've been around a long time, but I learned things. I learned a lot today. I was a bit surprised. I thought I knew it all. So we're glad you were here. Thank you very much. And now let me plug Margaret's book, The Hidden Language of Business. It's a great book. I'm sure it's on Amazon and wherever else, and we got a copy around here, which I have not yet read, but I'm going to read. I'm going to put it in my reading group. So, The Hidden Language of Business, Margaret Mulford. Now, a couple of other things. Our Emerging Leaders class starts November 7th. We still have a lot of slots open, 8 days over 8 months. If you're new in a leadership role or just moving up to a bigger leadership role, it's perfect for you. Let's see. Also, now, the class we just had on political rules, but we're going to have a one-day seminar on that coming up shortly. It'll be announced within the next few days. And finally, our next Lunch and Learn, we'll see you then November 16th with Susan Williams about storytelling. And I just wanted, from an editorial standpoint, from a leadership position, storytelling is the most important way you communicate culture in an organization. So join us on the 16th. And in the meantime, we'll see you next month. Bye-bye.